Ask any lawyer, or at least any lawyer who practices in federal court, and he or she will tell you that the nearest thing to God on earth is a federal judge sitting in his or her courtroom. Because you see, the power of a judge to govern that courtroom, to control the litigation, to control even the people in the courtroom, is about as absolute a power as any government official has anywhere on the planet. And they get those really nifty black robes, too. They have lifetime tenure. You can't fire them. You can't even lower their salaries. And so, who are these people? Can we trust them? Do they do a good job? Are they corrupted by this incredible job security they have? Or are they benevolent people who watch over us and our Constitution? It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about the federal judge.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier, with your host, Stuart Harris, who teaches at Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Johnson City attorney Tony Seaton's been on the show only once, but he had such a good time in his Access to Justice episode some time back, and he did such a good job that he offered, and I accepted, he offered to go out and line up a few interviews with some various judges he knows, and through his kind offices, I've talked to local judges, I've talked to justices of the Tennessee Supreme Court, and today I'm going to talk to a federal district judge from the Eastern District of Tennessee. His name is Ronnie Greer, and what a gentleman he is. How very smart, how very articulate, and how very forthcoming he is about this mysterious position that he holds, this position from which he cannot be fired, a position which the President of the United States himself appointed him to. I'm going to talk all this hour with Ronnie Greer, and he is going to tell you things you never realized about being a federal judge. And I think that at the end of this interview, you're going to be a lot more confident about our justice system and the people who run it.
Well, I'm Ronnie Greer. I am a United States District Judge in the Eastern District of Tennessee. I preside over the Greenville Division of the Eastern District. We have three divisions, the Southern Division in Chattanooga, the Northern Division in Knoxville, and the Northeastern Division in Greenville, and that's where I sit.
Well, I know how impressive it is to have a federal judge here in our studios today, and I know how excited I am to see you sitting there. But let's tell people who might not realize just how impressive that is exactly how a federal judge is selected.
Well, it's a fairly simple process. At least the description of the process is fairly simple. It's
right.
Not a simple process in practical application. Federal judges are appointed by the president.
So the president of the United States had to say, I want Ronnie Greer to be one of my federal judges.
That's right. And
which president was that?
That was George W. Bush.
Okay.
And then, of course, the nomination is subject to Senate confirmation. And that's essentially the process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about your process? Was it a difficult process? Was it a long process? Or was it easy?
Mine was relatively short. The process itself, as most people, I suspect, understand, is a rather political process.
Mm-hmm.
There's been politics in the selection of federal judges since George Washington and John Adams appointed their Federalist friends to
right.
to the bench. And so there is a fair amount of politics involved in it. Most presidents rely on the senators from a particular state who are of that president's political party to make recommendations. That is what happened here.
Right. Who were the senators back? It was 03, wasn't it?
It was in 03. Mm-hmm. My name was actually submitted to the White House by Senator Frist.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember Bill Frist, right.
Senator Thompson, and Fred Thompson.
Those are two blasts from the past. That's right. Two very prominent Republicans. Bill Frist was the majority leader.
He was the majority leader today.
And, of course, everybody knows who Thompson was.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then Senator Thompson left office at the first of the year. Senator Alexander took his seat, and I had the support of Senator Alexander as well. And then there was an appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee after all the background checks were done, and there was a vote of the full Senate, I guess, in June of 2003.
Right, and there was no great controversy then.
There was not. At that point, I was an appointee of a Republican president.
With the Republican Senate,
was controlled by the Republicans. It didn't hurt to have the majority leader
No, I'm sure that nobody wanted to make him angry, I'm sure.
Sort of in charge of the process, so my confirmation was a very smooth process.
Well, that's very nice to hear. And I'm glad you mentioned that it is an inherently political process because, of course, in a minute here, we'll be talking about, you know, that process, the federal process, perhaps versus state processes. But, you know, as much as you might try to take politics out of any selection, there's always politics. I mean, judges are political animals, and people who want to become judges are typically lawyers, and lawyers are political animals. So I'm it's probably a safe guess that you were a Republican prior to this time and that you were fairly active in the Republican
Party. I was active in Republican politics for a long time. I served in the Tennessee State Senate for 9 years as a Republican. So, yes, I had.
Of course, now that you are an Article III judge and you have life tenure, effectively, I mean, it's good behavior, I know, and I'm sure you behave well. And so effectively, you've got this job for as long as you wish. And that's a threshold question. I mean, the whole concept there is that you want to create this group of people who are no longer subject to political pressure.
Correct.
Who are people who can simply do justice and follow the law as they see fit. Do you feel that that's had that effect with you and with your fellow judges, federal judges?
Based on everything I see, yes, the system works very well. I think the founding fathers were very wise. They chose not to subject federal judges to election or to re-election. Federal judges are appointed for lifetime tenure. My view is, and my experience has been, that most federal judges go about their work very diligently, very deliberately, and that politics has almost nothing to do with it after one becomes a judge.
Right, because you don't have to be reappointed. You don't have to be certainly reelected. You don't have to worry, as any human being who needs a living, about your living. You don't have to worry about losing your paycheck if you decide a case one way that turns out to be politically unpopular in your state or in your region. And so, I think certainly speaking from the opposite perspective, I used to practice law and did some practicing in federal court. I think the perception generally among practitioners is that you're going to get a higher quality of justice in the federal system in general than you will in a state system in general, even though, of course, there are obvious exceptions and qualifications to that.
Well, speaking generally, I suspect that is true. state court judges in some states follow a similar appointment process, and others they run for election. My experience here in Tennessee has been that the Tennessee judiciary provides a very good result, but that's not always the case in some states. So I think generally speaking, I would agree with you that there is a better way of delivering justice in the federal courts than in many state courts.
Yeah, that's true. And I know that that's an ongoing debate. And in fact, the reason we're here today is because my buddy here in Johnson City, Tony Seaton, very, very nice lawyer who spoke to me
recently.
Good
lawyer.
Yeah, he's a good lawyer. And he spoke to me in a very popular episode called Access to Justice. He told me some time ago that he had a perception that many people who come to him, many people who speak to him, are sort of cynical about our justice system in the United States. And they'll say sort of offhand things like, oh, everyone's corrupt and now everyone's on the take. You know, he'll even get accused of being on the take when he doesn't get the result that his, you know, client might want. And so he asked me, you know, would you be willing to speak to some judges and address that basic question, you know, is our justice system corrupt or not? Are there problems with it? And if so, what are they? Do you have any general thoughts on that question?
Well, I think you're correct that there are a fair number of people who are quite cynical about the justice system. And I think there are people who level accusations of corruption and do so rather loosely. I think most of that is driven by people who do not agree with the outcome of particular
yes,
cases.
That's right, yeah.
I don't hear many allegations that there's actual, what I would call, dishonesty among judges, that, you know, things like bribery or things of that sort. I think most of that criticism comes from people who disagree with the decisions.
I think, yeah, that's been my perception as well. You mentioned the concept of bribery, and one of the bulwarks against bribery is the fact that, at least in the federal system, you have your job pretty much for life. And moreover, your pay cannot be reduced.
That's correct.
And that's a good thing. I mean, no one can threaten you with reducing your pay next year if you don't decide a case in a certain way. But the Chief Justice of the United States, not just this one, but previous Chief Justices, have bemoaned the fact that judicial pay for federal judges has lagged way behind where it should be. Do you sense that that creates an issue for you or your fellow federal judges? Does it create, in a general sense, does it create the possibility that a judge might feel like he's financially stressed and might then therefore be a little bit more inclined to accept money or something of that sort?
Well, at least in theory, salaries ought to be set at a level high enough to discourage that, right, as you said.
Right.
Salaries of federal judges are good salaries. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of disenchantment, a lot of grumbling, if you will, among federal judges for a lot of years because mm-hmm. Congress chose not to give federal judges the regular cost of living increases. There have been some improvements lately. But as a general rule, I think you're exactly right. Judges ought to be well paid to avoid any kind of that temptation. They ought to be paid commensurate, frankly, with what others of similar positions make and to some degree by reference to what they might make in private practice.
Exactly right. Now, if I were appointed to the federal bench today, roughly how much would I make in my first year as a federal judge?
Well, it's a matter of public record. It's slightly under $200,000 a year.
Okay. Now, by any standard, almost any standard, that's a very generous salary.
Yes, it is.
And so that's a very good living that someone can certainly live on. It's more than I make. But law professors are kind of in that same boat as with federal judges, is that at least in theory, we could make a great deal more if we were out in private practice.
Right.
And federal judges, again, to give you another compliment, is that they are, generally speaking, very successful lawyers before they're appointed, and they're on a career trajectory and a salary trajectory where they could probably make a lot more money staying in private practice. So on that basis, do you think it would be appropriate, for example, to significantly increase federal judicial salaries?
Well, I think that's a question better addressed to the policymakers in Congress.
Right.
I will tell you this. I don't think many people seek the position of federal judge because of the salary.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a federal judge now 11 years. I make less now than I made the last year I practiced law before becoming a judge.
Wow.
So I don't think that's what necessarily motivates people to seek the position. It is a very stimulating job. It is a job that involves public service.
Right.
And I think that's what motivates people who want to get involved in the system and do the right thing.
Yeah, that's very similar to the what I've heard law professors say, is that many of them feel like they could make a lot more. I was talking to my old law school roommate recently. I won't give you the details. Let's just say he's on a very different trajectory than I am. And yet you're right. I mean, you choose a different career path because you can make a living, you can live on the salary, but it is also something that has many other compensations. But just from an institutional viewpoint, I'll actually take your part on this one. From an institutional viewpoint, I think federal judges should make a lot more money than they do because the gap between what they could make and what they do make is so enormous now. I think that elected officials, including the President of the United States on down, including members of Congress, should make a lot more money than they do, especially given that Congress people have two homes that they typically are trying to maintain. And one of the main reasons is because we want to eliminate any desire on their part or any perceived need on their part to be corrupted. I think it's good public policy. It's not just a matter of paying people well for a job well done. It's good public policy. Getting back to our theme of corruption, another allegation that's occasionally leveled against judges is that they get too many junkets, that under the guise of so-called educational programs, mm-hmm. that they will be taken by this right-wing group or that left-wing group or this industry group or that union group and sent off to Vail, Colorado for some period of time. And, it's all ostensibly for educational purposes, but they spent a lot of time on the slopes. Do you perceive that as a problem?
Well, first of all, I don't know many judges who've taken those junkets.
Uh-huh.
There are a few who do. I think in the 11 years I've been on the bench, I have attended one privately funded seminar. That was at George Mason Law School.
Mm-hmm.
It was a program about antitrust law. And although people occasionally say those are slanted toward one viewpoint or another, I did not find that to be the case during that program. I thought it was a very helpful educational program. And that's what I hear from other judges who attend those as well. Those are fully reported so that the public knows that the judges are attending those, and the organizations who sponsor those now have to disclose their sources of funding. So if the public wants to know about those, the information is there. But I do not see very much evidence that there are right-wing groups or left-wing groups or any other groups really overtly influencing the decisions of federal judges through those educational seminars.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm getting to do something I never got to do in practice, and that is getting to ask the questions of a federal judge, putting the hard questions to him. We've just been talking to Federal District Judge Ronnie Greer of the Eastern District of Tennessee, and I've been asking him about corrupting influences in the federal judiciary, and he's been giving me some really straightforward answers. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and I'll grill Judge Ronnie Greer some more. Stick around. Well, it's that magical time of day, that magical time of the show when we invite the quiz guy, Doug Smith. How are you, Doug?
Bonjour, monsieur.
Guten Tag, ja auch.
Ni hao.
Now, that one I'm going to leave. I have no idea where that is. Is that Chinese?
It is Chinese.
So is what I'm guessing we have a foreign theme today.
It is about treaties.
Treaties. Excellent. The treaty power. I'm excited.
Yeah. So I just, you know, it's a simple question. So whatever.
Simple.
Yeah. It's just about treaties and who.
Wait. Yeah. Who's on the line? What?
I was just so close to giving you the question.
Oh, don't give me the question. Don't give me the question. We got to have a contestant. Do we have a contestant here today?
Yeah. My name is Taylor from Hayside, Virginia.
Hayside, Virginia. That is quite near Grundy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's tremendous. I've heard a story about the origin of Hayside. I've heard that there used to be a ferry there, and that the ferry operator was named Cy, and that when people saw him, they would say, "Hey, Cy," and therefore they started calling that area Hayside. Now, is there any truth at all to that story?
I've heard that before, too, so it might be true, but I don't know.
Well, in any event, it's a good story, right?
Right.
Okay, Taylor. Well, Doug, do you have a question for Taylor?
No, I don't have any questions.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
I have a question about treaties.
About treaties, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Taylor,
I'm
here
sorry,
it comes.
I was thinking about Hayside. Oh, okay.
Here you go, Taylor. Ready?
All right, I'm ready.
What body must approve a treaty? Is it A, the Senate, B, the House of Representatives, or C, both houses of Congress?
Ooh.
Who must approve a treaty? The Senate, House of Representatives, or both houses of Congress?
And of course, you mean by that before it goes into effect. So if this particular institution, whether it's the Senate, the House, or both, doesn't approve it, it doesn't go into effect.
That's right.
Okay. Taylor, do you have any idea?
I'm going to go with C.
See, both of them, both houses of Congress. Why do you say that?
C is always a good answer.
That's what I told my parents when when I came home with this report card in calculus.
C's were always good.
I was like, C is great.
C is always great. Well, you have to have more analysis than that. Now, why would you say that, other than C always being good?
I feel like a treaty is a pretty serious thing, so you want to have both of them to approve it.
Well, that actually makes sense. There's a fair amount of logic there. So I'm not going to talk you out of that answer then, huh?
No.
Okay.
Not unless you're going to tell me the right answer.
Oh, I'm not going to tell you the right answer. I'm going to try to sow doubt and cast aspersions. Doug, what do you got there?
Well, she should have taken you up on your down sowing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's the Senate.
Why is it the Senate?
But
Taylor
majority.
Just said it's important. Shouldn't you have both houses?
Yeah, it is very, very important. The president negotiates the treaties. The Senate has to be the one that passes the treaties.
Oh, but why? Why just the Senate, I'm wondering? Why not the House, too?
Well, you know, the Senate also is the one who has to confirm ambassadors. And so there's an interesting check and balance there. If the Senate is the one saying, yeah, this ambassador is legit, it's this ambassador, she's going to, you know, represent well these other countries, then when that negotiated treaty comes before them, they have to have reasonable confidence.
Oh.
Yeah, but it,
Yeah, Taylor, basically, if you go back to the founding and you look at it, the House of Representatives, incidentally, your logic is impeccable. Okay, that's right. It is important. But when you look back to the way the founders looked at the Congress, they said the House is the people's house. That is, you know, common folk or relatively common folk can get themselves elected for relatively short terms. And that's important because especially in things like taxes, we need to have broad representation. But we also have this other body that's smaller. It's only two people per state. So it's going to be powerful people, educated people, wealthy people. They're sort of supposed to be the wise men. They're the president's counselors, at least when it comes to foreign policy. And so we're going to give them a special role when it comes to foreign policy. As Doug said, appointing ambassadors, doing things like declaring war or not, and also ultimately approving treaties or not.
Straight out of Article 2.
Yeah, and that's and that is why they choose the Senate for those particular jobs. Also probably because everyone knew the House was going to keep getting bigger and bigger as population grew. And at a certain point, it becomes unwieldy. I mean, can you imagine trying to get the House to pass anything today?
Well, you know, it's funny. Your line of argument there, Stuart, was interesting because you suggested for a moment that the House might be less stable than the Senate.
I just have the sense that maybe it is. Maybe the House is a bit less stable.
What I love is the fact that it really is the president who manages and negotiates those treaties, and it comes to the Senate. And the Senate also confirms these ambassadors for their positions. I think that's a nice check and balance there. And it continues to install in the executive the power of those international relations.
Yep.
And there's something to be said for that. I mean, you mentioned a second ago about the House of Representatives. I don't think we want anyone in Congress representing at a global scale creating treaties. I think you want that to be the executive, and we want them to provide the check and balance for what the executive branch is doing.
A very good exposition, Doug. Well, I'm so sorry, Taylor, that you didn't get a T-shirt, but you did get a pocket copy of the Constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. So that's a good thing now, isn't it?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Tremendous. Thank you so much for your time. We really do appreciate it. And thank you, Doug.
Hey, no problem, Stuart. This is always fun to do with you.
It is fun.
Yeah, we should do it more often.
I think we should.
Maybe every week.
What an idea.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
I'm a federal judge and I'm smarter than you. For all my life, I can do whatever I want to do. For all my life, bring to me discovery. No matter what the issue is, I guarantee somebody will be sanctioned as the penalty, and there'll be no error. Decisions cannot be questioned by you. I'm always right, and my wise discretion is never abused. For all my life, think of me as royalty when you appear before.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Federal District Judge Ronnie Greer. Before the break, I was pushing the judge a little bit, and I was asking him if all these junkets that I hear about these federal judges taking, all of these supposed educational programs, are somehow pushing judges to the right or to the left, if the sponsors of those programs are trying to corrupt our federal judiciary. He said he doesn't think so. And let's pick up the discussion there.
Well, I can see where you're coming from because this show is actually underwritten by Montpelier, James Madison's historic home. And specifically, we work very closely with the Center for the Constitution there.
Right.
Have you been out there?
I have not.
Oh,
no.
You need to go.
I do need to go.
Talk to me sometime. I'll get you. I can't give you tickets. I can't. We'll make sure you get over there sometime.
All right. I need to go.
Without corrupting you. But I know at the Center for the Constitution, they have lots and lots of educational seminars, including occasionally for judges. Mm-hmm. And indeed, a colleague of mine and a friend of mine who's on our board of trustees at the Appalachian School of Law, Elizabeth McClanahan, is a state Supreme Court justice in Virginia. And I know that she's actually been to one of the educational seminars they have there specifically for judges, and she loves going there. Now, if you go to one of those seminars, you'll go there, and they'll probably give you a meal or two along the way, and they'll probably give you a place to stay on Montpelier's grounds. And I think that the focus is going to be completely on education, and I'm glad to have judges going to those sorts of things and getting together and talking about these things and having a little bit of a retreat, getting away from the office for a while and coming back refreshed and with new perspectives.
There are also a number of publicly funded educational programs. The Federal Judicial Center sponsors regular seminars on various topics. That's all publicly funded. Judges are encouraged to attend those. And although I have not attended those seminars regularly, I have found them very useful because they focus on a very specific area of the law, often a very specialized area of the law. But maybe the best thing about them is that it gives an individual judge an opportunity to have a lot of interaction with other judges, to talk about procedures, to talk about more efficient ways to manage a docket or to handle cases, and just to establish relationships that are often helpful on a day-to-day basis in getting the work of the courts done.
Well, now let me ask you a couple of very general questions.
All right.
What is the best thing about being a federal judge? And while you're thinking about that very general question, I will tell you that the perception from the practitioner's viewpoint is that the closest thing to being God on earth is to be somebody like you, at least within the confines of your courtroom. I mean, we revere federal judges, and to some extent we fear them, because when I walk into your courtroom as a practitioner, what you say goes, and there's very, very little check on what, I mean, you've got a great deal of what we like to call discretion in running your courtroom and
Correct.
Conducting the litigation. So it looks awful good from the perspective of those guys standing in front of you and arguing. Is it as good as it looks?
No. With that authority comes a great deal of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know any federal judges, frankly, who abuse that authority. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, it is an enormous amount of authority because, after all, in the right circumstances, a federal district judge could, in fact, order the President of the United States to do something.
And it happens from time to time,
doesn't
it? It
happens from time
to
time. So it is an immense authority. But at the same time, I think most judges understand that and understand that it comes with the responsibility of exercising that authority very carefully, very deliberately. And so I acknowledge that that authority is there. And certainly within the confines of the courtroom, I'm the boss. And what I say goes, whether I'm right or wrong. If I'm wrong, there's an appellate process that can be followed. But maybe the best thing about the job is that it is a real opportunity, in my view, to serve the public. And I really do think that's what motivates most people, whether in the federal or the state judiciary, to do their jobs on a day-to-day basis. If you ask me what I dislike about it, there's a long list of those things. I mean,
that was my next question, so well, please go to it.
I'll tell you, over the 11 years I've been on the bench, I have probably sentenced 2,000 defendants in criminal cases.
Hmm.
The federal sentencing guidelines are quite harsh in some cases. There are many mandatory minimum sentences that federal judges have to impose. I approach every sentencing very deliberately. I read every bit of information I can get about that case. I try to learn as much as I can about that individual defendant. And even when I make the decision that I know is the right decision, I still regret having to impose that sentence. And there are days when I wish somebody else had that responsibility. When I'm dealing with a very hard case with very hard issues in it, I feel the same way. Maybe the thing that I dislike the most about being a federal judge is the isolation. I can no longer be involved in politics. I can no longer be involved in community affairs. I cannot state public opinions about any kind of disputed issue. I don't associate with lawyers like I used to. Some days I go into the federal courthouse in Greenville, go up a back elevator, and I don't see anybody but my judicial assistant and my two law clerks all day long. And so it's isolating, but, The good things about it are far heavier, in my view, than the bad things.
You mentioned, that does, I mean, I imagine it is isolating. Let me ask you this. You mentioned something about not speaking out on disputed issues. Republican Party versus White, very important case a few years back about judicial elections and state judicial elections. Actually is widely perceived as a vindication of the First Amendment rights of judicial candidates to speak freely. Okay, that's fine. So you, just like every other American citizen, even though I know you're not running for election, but you, any judge, just like every other American citizen, has First Amendment rights. And so any infringement of those rights is going to be taken very seriously. And yet, as a judge, constrained by the canons of judicial ethics, there are certain things you cannot say. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, on any issue that could potentially be the subject of litigation in federal court, I simply should not take a or express a public opinion about that.
You can't say anything, can you?
I can't say anything about it.
I mean, but there is so much that could come in front of a federal court. Wow. Talk about your chilling effect on speech.
Well, that's true. But I think the need to provide a judge who is who is unbiased, who's willing to apply the law, not his or her own personal views, outweighs the First Amendment rights in those situations. And of course, it's not an absolute prohibition. I could state my opinion, but then if that case came before me, my obligation would be to recuse and let somebody else decide the case. And I think it's when judges create that perception that they have already prejudged cases that causes people to come away from a judicial proceeding with a bad taste in their mouth about the judiciary, to feel that it is corrupt, or that to be cynical about the result. So I do my best to give every litigant who comes in a fair hearing to have their say, and then do the best I can to decide the issue based on the law and the facts of that case rather than my own personal opinions about it.
Isn't that a remarkable contrast then? Within your courtroom, you can say and do pretty much whatever you think is right without constraint. In your judicial opinions that you write, you can explain with as much detail as you wish why you're doing what you're doing. But those are really the only ways that you can speak freely. When you step outside the courtroom, and when somebody like me wants to ask you questions, you always have to be thinking to yourself, I better not say this, or I better not say that, or I need to stay away from this because I don't want to prejudice a future case. I don't want to have to recuse myself or be subject to a disqualification.
Correct. Yeah.
Wow. In fact, now again, I don't. If I'm going to ask a specific question about another federal judge, and if you don't want to comment, that's fine. But I seem to recall about 10 years ago, there was a judge named Thomas Penfield Jackson who gave press interviews about a case. I think it was a Microsoft antitrust case during the case, and then was disqualified from continuing in that case. So that's an example of what can happen, isn't it? Is Judge Jackson still on the bench?
I honestly don't know.
I don't know. I haven't kept up with it.
You know, even today, there are a number of judges, both appeals court judges and district judges, who maintain blogs. And who talk about those kinds of issues. Judge Posner is
the most prominent
of those. And I look at his blog every now and then. He expresses opinions on all kinds of things. As a general rule, I think that's bad practice. It's just judges ought not to be engaged in that public debate. But, you know, some feel like they need to do that. And they're, as you say, exercising their First Amendment right to do it. But sometimes it creates a question about prejudging cases or prejudging issues.
I'm going to have to call up Judge Posner sometime and ask him about that, because just for people who don't know about him particularly, he is widely considered to be among the most prominent federal judges who's not on the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And I actually did interview his son, Eric Posner, who's a law professor at the University of Chicago, and was a great interview, by the way. We talked all about the debt crisis, the federal debt crisis, and the ways around it about a year ago when that was very much when default was on the table. But be that as it may, Judge Posner is considered to be one of the most persuasive and influential legal commentators out there. And isn't that odd that he's doing that as a federal judge? I wonder how many times he gets motions to disqualify.
That's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you're right. He is a very well-respected judge, considered to be an intellectual.
Right.
His opinions, his appellate opinions, probably carry as much precedential weight as some Supreme Court decisions. People watch what he is doing. They read his opinions.
If I had him here, I would ask him, you know, isn't it enough to have that level of influence? And don't you have a big enough megaphone already through your judicial opinions, even your dissents and concurrences, Judge? I would ask him, why do you feel a need to blog as well? And then, of course, that's a point at which he'd he'd leave the room and off. That's probably why I'm never going to interview him.
Well, it's interesting question.
Yeah, that is an interesting question.
Because you're right, judges generally speak through their oral pronouncements in court or through their written opinions.
Right.
And not otherwise.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Today I'm speaking with Federal District Judge Ronnie Greer of the Eastern District of Tennessee. And man, he is giving us the inside scoop on what it means to be a federal judge. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll finish our discussion with Federal District Judge Ronnie Greer. Stick around. And now let's finish our discussion with Federal District Judge Ronnie Greer of the Eastern District of Tennessee. And all of this, all of our discussion today about whether there's corruption or perceived corruption in the judiciary and the federal judiciary in particular, goes to the heart of a very, very important concept. And maybe this is where we'll conclude our discussion, the concept of the rule of law. As I always tell my law students, courts don't have armies. Okay, they can't go out and enforce their opinions. They depend upon the other branches of government, particularly the executive, to enforce them for them, right, if push comes to shove. Most of the time, though, and in most circumstances, when the judge issues a ruling, there's simply an expectation that the parties will follow it. And yes, by and large, the parties do follow it because they, even the losing parties, who might be really, really angry, respect the rule of law. And so to the extent people do perceive the court system as being corrupt, that erodes the rule of law. And to the extent that the opposite is true, that we think that it's a good functioning system, then the rule of law is strengthened. Could you talk a little bit about the importance of the rule of law?
Well, I think it is critically important for people to have confidence in the judiciary, which is, by the way, a co-equal branch of the government.
Right.
I think it's important that courts apply rules and that people follow the court's pronouncements. Occasionally, I have presided over cases down through the years involving police officers or other elected officials, or in one case, a judge, a state court judge. And it's always a topic of conversation when it comes time to sentence in those cases, how important the rule of law is, and that nobody, whether a policeman or a judge or the president of the United States, is above the law. I think that's absolutely foundational to our system of justice, and critically important, as I said.
Mm-hmm. If we don't follow the law, then our entire experiment breaks down, because that is one way of looking at what we often call the American experience. Can people govern themselves through a representative democracy? And if we don't follow our own laws, if we allow the powerful, whether they be politicians or simply wealthy people or however they define power, if we allow them to operate by different rules, then that, again, tends to erode and break down the system. I noticed that in Italy recently, Silvio Berlusconi, the former prime minister, right, was recently convicted of tax evasion while serving as their prime minister. And recently received what seems to be an awfully light sentence. I think community service one day a week for 3 years, which really is not that heavy. I wonder, I don't know a lot about it, I wonder whether that very light sentence in that very serious case tends to undercut the faith of the general Italian voter in the rule of law in his nation or her nation.
It may very well. Mm-hmm. That's understandable. People see a high-ranking official who has committed a criminal offense, who gets a very lenient sentence, and it's a legitimate question to ask. Going back to the rule of law, I often hear from defendants, especially in criminal cases, that they disagree with the law.
Mm-hmm.
I hear that in gun cases. I hear that in marijuana cases a lot.
Sure, sure.
And I always say to them, you're entitled to that opinion. Maybe you're right in your opinion, but that's an argument that needs to be addressed to the United States Congress, not to this court. Because my job is to apply the law as Congress has written it, not to make the law. And if you want to talk about making the law, then you need to address that argument to Congress.
But let's talk about that, because you or any other judge does actually make law, at least on occasion, when you get a case of first impression or when you're interpreting a statute, which is, of course, a law adopted by the legislature and passed by the executive for the first time. And if you decide a case for the first time, that case can then become a precedent that other courts will look to and possibly follow. And if enough courts follow it for enough time, and especially if it goes all the way up the chain of appeal and the Supreme Court of the United States follows it, then effectively, with that stroke of your pen as a federal judge, you have in some sense made what we call common law. Could you talk a little bit about that function of the judiciary, which is often misunderstood or mischaracterized as being some sort of overreach? Could you just comment on that?
Well, not only do we apply the law, we also interpret the law, as you just mentioned.
Right.
Just as people do not speak precisely sometimes or write precisely, Congress doesn't do that either. There's often ambiguity in the meaning of statutes passed by Congress, and so it falls on the courts to interpret those statutes, to figure out what Congress meant by its use of a certain word or a certain phrase. And in that sense, I guess you are correct. The courts do make law. Of course, there's an appellate process that where those decisions can be reviewed. If I interpret a statute, it's a question of first impression. My decision is almost certainly going to be appealed to the Sixth Circuit, and that court's ruling may be appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And if the court then interprets the statute in a way that Congress disagrees with it, Congress can certainly revise the statute, pass a new statute, clarify what it's said, which they often do in reaction to a court decision. But you're correct, that that is a big part of what courts do.
Yep, and an unavoidable part.
It is.
So frequently I know that judges, maybe especially federal judges, maybe especially in constitutional cases, are criticized as being activist judges, whether they're conservative or liberal. Oh, you're just making the law up. Well, sometimes you have to. Sometimes, you know, that's a bad way of putting it. But as you say, you have to interpret the law. And to some extent, that involves creativity. It involves thought. It involves weighing policy alternatives, things that maybe ideally the legislature would do, but the legislature doesn't always do. And you got to decide the case in front of you. So there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
As long as it's done properly, however we define that.
In fact, that's been part of our system for a long time.
Since the very beginning.
We mentioned a few minutes ago the fact that the process for a person to become a federal judge is a political process.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Marbury versus Madison.
Oh, yeah.
Which arose out of judicial appointments that established the principle in the first instance that courts could review statutes for constitutionality. I thinking about that coming up here because I knew generally what your subject was. That all arose out of the fact that John Adams appointed some judges on the last day of his term, and it's said that he was signing the commissions at midnight mm-hmm. before he left office. Didn't get them all signed,
right?
And then the Jefferson administration would not issue commissions for those judges, and so that all ended up in
they said they couldn't
litigation.
Find them. Commission? What commission? I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Marbury.
So it goes all the way back.
It does. In fact, you mentioned John Adams earlier, and in addition to those were actually low-level federal judges, D.C. magistrates. But just a little bit earlier before this, of course, John Marshall appointed the so-called midnight judges, which were new Article III judges. And I think those were all pretty much fired the next year by a new act of Congress. But the most important act of what you might call court packing at that point was, in my mind at least, was when Adams was unexpectedly confronted with the resignation of the Chief Justice of the United States. I believe it was Oliver Ellsworth.
I believe that's right.
In the very last month or two of his presidency, and he looked and looked and looked and tried to get somebody, a Federalist, to quickly take that job. And the story goes that he went to John Jay, who had been the first Chief Justice, offered him the job again, and Jay responded, "Nah, that Supreme Court doesn't have any power. It never will have any power, and I don't want to waste my time." But then instead, he ended up giving it to John Marshall.
Right.
And to my mind, that was one of the most important decisions John Adams ever made, because as you know, John Marshall served for, 34, 35
long time.
Years?
Yes, yeah. Long time.
In a formative period of our constitutional interpretation, and he really set a course which was very much a Federalist course that outlasted the Federalist Party itself. So you guys, you federal judges, are very important people because you can live a long time. And you can have an effect and be making this law, interpreting the law in very important ways for a very long period of time. So I guess the probably your ambition, like that of every other federal judge, is to be very healthy.
Well, and most federal judges serve for a long time.
They do. They really do.
Some serve for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true on the Supreme Court, too. I saw Justice Scalia in Knoxville yesterday.
How's he looking?
Well, he looks perfectly healthy.
Uh-huh.
He looks
he's
fine.
He's getting kind of old now, isn't he?
He's in his 70s.
Yeah. Late 70s, I think.
I heard somebody there say that he has 9 children and 34 grandchildren.
Wow.
But, you know, he's been there for a long time, as have a number of his colleagues. And presidents look for people to appoint to the courts who are going to be expected to serve for a long time because of just what you said. We have this idea of stare decisis precedent, and what that basically means to people who've never heard it before means that each case builds on the ones that were decided before it. So it's not uncommon for me to write an opinion. And that's one thing that differentiates the federal courts from the state courts. You will see sometimes very long opinions written by federal judges. We issue a written opinion on practically everything we do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all uncommon for me to cite opinions that were decided 40 or 50 or 60 or several decades ago.
Mm-hmm. Because they're still good law.
They are still good law.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I sometimes have to point out to people when I'm speaking to the public or on this radio show. There are a lot of people who want to interpret the Constitution simply by reading the document itself and saying it means this. And they don't want to acknowledge the fact that it's been around for 200 some odd years and that lots and lots of very smart people have argued for a long, long time over what exactly those words mean. And there are lots and lots of judicial opinions out there that we still rely upon, that are part of the framework, the superstructure of constitutional law that we've erected on the top, with the written document itself as the foundation. So when you say constitutional law, we spend at least a year in law school studying it, and many students spend a lot longer time. And I'll tell you what, there's always something new to learn. So if I get frustrated, it's with people who say, well, I can read the Constitution and it means this. Well, maybe it does and maybe it doesn't, but you haven't even looked at, you know, 90% of what's out there on that subject.
If they go back and read the history, they might find out that there was actually some disagreement among the founders who wrote those words about what they meant as well.
Yes, indeed.
And some of them were the result of a compromise.
Oh, yes.
In order to get a Constitution in place. So it's not nearly as simple as just reading the document or saying that, you know, this is a situation that the founders couldn't have foreseen. Well, clearly, there are a lot of situations that arise where the founders couldn't have foreseen the specific facts and circumstances. But they laid out the general principles, and that's what courts are required to do, is apply those principles to the circumstances that exist. Now, I don't want to get into this debate about whether we have I think what some people refer to as a living constitution, mm-hmm. that it changes with the times and all that. But what I'm saying is that the basic principles of the Constitution have not changed. But circumstances do, and judges are called upon to apply those old principles that have been around for a long time to new circumstances. And in that sense, I guess we go back to the issue of making law sometimes. And most of the people who see that as being activists, those charges are generally leveled, I think, by the people who simply disagree with the decision.
Yeah. The best definition I've heard of judicial activist is a judge you disagree with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I've kept you here a long time, Judge, and I really do appreciate your insights. Before we finish up, is there anything you'd care to add?
Well, I don't know. I guess I might go back to where I started. I think the founders were very wise. Article 3 judges do get their positions out of a political process, but the founders were wise when they made it a lifetime appointment. They were wise when they took us out of the political arena. There's something sort of unseemly to me for a judge to go out and raise money and debate issues that are coming before a court in a political campaign and do all those things that people who run for office have to do. And I realize that at the state level, there's a big debate about that. You know, to the extent I can take a position, I took positions back years ago on those issues. I served in the state Senate in Tennessee from 1986 to 1994. And if you go back and look at those bills, you'll find my name as a co-sponsor on some of the Missouri Plan bills. And I have just always felt that the founders were smart in doing what they did. And that doesn't mean the state systems have to be the same way, but I think it does mean that that is a position that has to be considered carefully by anybody who's making policy at the state level. I think the federal system benefits from that considerably and contributes to the idea, as we've discussed earlier today, that the federal system does produce better results. I tell practitioners all the time that I like the federal system, and that's where I always concentrated my practice when I was practicing law, because the rules are somewhat clear. The deadlines are much firmer. Cases move along at a much faster pace often. And so it's there's a lot of debate going on about those, and those are issues that the policymakers will have to decide. But I do think the founders had a good idea when they set up the federal judiciary the way they did.
Okay, last question, personal question. Feel free not to answer it if you don't want to. But given that you have life tenure effectively, any plans to retire ever, or are they going to have to carry you out of your courtroom in the middle of a trial in a box?
No, I suspect I will retire at some point. I'm eligible to retire in 4 years. Judges can retire. They can take what's called senior status, which means take a reduced caseload.
Yeah, that's kind of a sweet deal. You can sort of become a part-time federal judge, can't you?
You can.
Yeah.
And when a judge chooses to take senior status, the president can go ahead and fill the vacancy. I'm a little bit uncertain right now just how long I will work. I have told my colleagues on the bench that if I ever get to the point where I'm simply not able to do the job, not mentally capable of doing the job, I expect them to tell me that. I mean, there comes a time when judges ought to leave. Others can serve quite well until the day they're carried out. But I don't know what my plans are in that respect, but probably to retire at some point.
Well, I have the closest thing to life tenure that a non-federal judge can have. I have tenure at my law school, and I have already told them they're going to carry me out. I am not leaving.
Can't say that I disagree with that.
Well, Judge Ronnie Greer of the Eastern District Federal Court in Tennessee, thank you very much for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Federal District Judge Ronnie Greer of the Eastern District of Tennessee. Wasn't that a just fascinating and pleasant and well thought out and extremely civil discussion? I had a great time, and I hope you did too. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment. Next time on your weekly Constitutional. You know, you ever hear about or read about a federal judge declaring this or that law unconstitutional or making this or that important decision? Who are those guys? How do they get picked? What do they do? Well, we're going to address all of those mysteries when we talk to Ronnie Greer of the Eastern District of Tennessee.